Hello. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you to today's educational activity titled Closing Gaps in Care for Short Bowel Syndrome in the Community Setting. This is an activity supported by an educational grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals USA Incorporated. Today's program may include discussion of products that are not currently FDA labeled. Faculty are aware of their responsibility to disclose if they are discussing off-label or investigational uses of products. I'm Don Kirby. I'm the director of the Center for Human Nutrition and the medical director for intestinal transplant at the Cleveland Clinic. I'm also a professor of medicine. I'm joined today by Anne Deborah Feldman, who will introduce herself.
Hello, I am Ann Deborah Feldman, and I work with Dr. Kirby in the Department of Nutrition at the Cleveland Clinic.
Here are the three learning objectives for today's program. First, identify the pathophysiology and associated risk factors, including disease-related complications of short bowel syndrome. The second learning objective is to evaluate available and emerging short bowel syndrome treatment strategies to promote enteral autonomy and reduce the need for parenteral nutrition. The third learning objective is to develop interdisciplinary and interprofessional coordinated care plans for patients with short bowel syndrome being managed in the community setting. Let's start with part one, pathophysiology and complications associated with intestinal failure due to short bowel syndrome. First, let's get the audience involved with an audience response question. Which of the following is the most common etiology for short bowel syndrome? Please select your answer from the following options: A, inflammatory bowel disease, B, malignancy, C, surgical complications, D, strangulated hernias, E, I don't know. The correct answer is surgical complications. So, what is intestinal failure? This is a term that is not very common in the US. It's very common in Europe, and intestinal failure is a reduction of gut function below the minimum necessary for absorption of macronutrients and/or water and electrolytes, so that IV supplementation is required to maintain health and or growth. If IV supplementation is not required or you've been able to wean a patient off it, it is termed intestinal insufficiency. There's a lot of heterogeneity with intestinal failure. This can be acquired, or mostly in pediatrics, can be congenital, can be gastrointestinal or systemic, benign or malignant. It may be an abrupt onset or from a slowly progressive chronic disorder, and self-limited or long-lasting. There are three types of classifications for this, type one being acute, short-term, and often self-limiting. Type two is a prolonged acute condition, often in metabolically unstable patients that require multidisciplinary team care and IV supplementation for weeks to months. And type three is chronic intestinal failure, where patients require IV supplementation over months to years, which can be reversible or irreversible. So, what is short bowel syndrome? This is the most common cause of chronic intestinal failure. Patients with less than 200 centimeters of functional small bowel. Important to get an accurate length of the remaining bowel, either by looking at old records. Hopefully, your surgeon may have measured this for you and it'll be in the operative report. Or sometimes radiologists can measure this with a CT enterography or MR enterography with a device called an opsiometer. And that may be a good guesstimate of how much bowel remains. The clinical features really vary depending on the extent of anatomy that has been lost and the ability of the patient and the remaining intestine to adapt to that loss. Treatment may vary depending on the disease severity and the type of resection the patient has had. So the potential for rehabilitation from intestinal failure to intestinal insufficiency is what we are trying to achieve for most of our patients. The etiologies of short bowel syndrome are all listed here. The most common are caused basically from surgical complications that cause short bowel syndrome. I'm in an inflammatory bowel center, so I see a lot of patients that have either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis that have had multiple surgeries that have shortened their bowel so that they are now so short that they require intravenous nutrition or enteral nutrition. Let's look very briefly at normal intestinal function. Believe it or not, we have a total of 8 to 9 liters entering the GI tract a day. On most days, except perhaps Super Bowl Sunday, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, our oral intake is roughly 2 liters. We have roughly 1.5 liters of salivary juice, 2.5 to 3 liters of gastric juice, 500 cc's of biliary juice, pancreatic juice is another 1.5 liters, and the overall intestine may contribute another liter. And since we don't spend most days in the bathroom, our gut really does a great job of reabsorbing this fluid. The small intestine will reabsorb about 7 liters and the large intestine about 1.5 liters. The small intestine is responsible for digesting and then absorbing our carbohydrates, fats, proteins, our cations, and vitamins and minerals. And the small intestine and large intestine will absorb water and electrolytes basically throughout the entire gut. The short bowel anatomy and types are listed here, and these are very important. Knowing the anatomy and what the patient has left or has lost can help you predict how you're going to be able to treat them and approach their care. Type 1 is the most difficult patient to deal with. Here, they will have an angiogenostomy and they'll have rapid transit. They'll have significant acid hypersecretion, especially in the first 6 to 12 months after a surgical resection. Adaptation is very poor because there's not enough surface area to really adapt, and you lose a lot of the absorptive capacity of the gut here. There are going to be large fluid losses. We may see in excess of 7 to 9 liters being lost out of an ostomy if these patients do not listen and be careful with their intake. We see significant maldigestion as well as malabsorption. And if they have less than 100 centimeters left, this is really the category that's going to have the worst prognosis. Type 2, you've got some jejunum attached to a colon, and the transit again is going to be fairly rapid. Again, because the jejunum does not adapt very well, that's going to be an issue. You're going to lose the, I call them parking spaces, if you will, for vitamin B12, which are in the terminal ileum, as well as the sites where we reabsorb bile salts, which is also the terminal ileum. And if you have colon left, the remaining bile that makes it to the colon can be very irritating and add to diarrhea. So, with this type of anatomy, you're going to have a very variable calorie and fluid absorption. In patients that have less than 65 centimeters of small bowel left, they're going to be the hardest to really rehabilitate. Type 3 is the least common type that you're going to see in practice, but it is the best prognosis and the patients that you may have the best chance of getting off parenteral nutrition once they are on it. And absorption can be very good unless up to 75% of small bowel has been resected. Again, adaptation may be good. This transit may be slower, but again, this is uncommon and the prognosis is generally good unless you have less than 30 centimeters of small bowel to that colon. So when we look at short bowel syndrome, we need to look at the causes of maldigestion and malabsorption. Again, you're going to see rapid intestinal transit with these patients, and this gives less time for the food to mix in the intestine that remains with your digestive enzymes. So you're going to not digest well or maldigest. And if you maldigest, you then malabsorb. The acid hypersecretion has several ramifications. It can inactivate your endogenous pancreatic enzymes because of the changes in pH. And there's a decreased peptide YY, which is what we call the ileal brake, and generally tries to slow the gut down for you. And there may be bacterial overgrowth. The motility may or may not be good. It may be sluggish. There may be strictures left over, so obstructions. The loss of the ileocecal valve allows colonic bacteria to go back up and populate the small bowel. Changes in pH can also make sure that the bacteria can thrive. The loss of surface area also decreases the secretion of secretin and CCK, which can lead to the failure to release pancreatic enzymes effectively. So, again, adding to maldigestion, leading to malabsorption. And bile acid wasting may also occur. And if you do not have your bile acids, you're going to impair micelle formation and not absorb fat well. The clinical presentations for short bowel syndrome vary very little between pediatrics and adult, diarrhea being the main thing that you're going to see. The pediatric patients may have a little more reflux, some gas, abdominal pain. The worst thing that we see with the pediatric group is poor growth and weight gain. If you get them in their early teens and you're not providing significant nutrition support, either enterally or parenterally, they can miss their growth spurt, and you'll see patients come in with their families and their siblings. And these are going to be the shortest of the group because they have lost that growth spurt. They are also going to present with vitamin and mineral deficiencies. In adults, diarrhea, again, the main thing, but you're going to see multiple episodes of dehydration, perhaps, along with gas pains, bloating, abdominal pain, fatigue, malnutrition, and vitamin and mineral deficiencies. If I had to say which is the most important slide of this presentation, it would be this one. Achieving an early and accurate diagnosis. If you don't suspect that this patient has short bowel syndrome based on the patient's history or multiple presentations to an emergency room for dehydration, or electrolyte abnormalities, then you're missing the boat. Lab studies are going to be important. Fecal fat tests, you were probably taught in medical school that you have to do a 72-hour fecal fat collection, giving them 100 grams of fat, dot, dot, dot. You can do this a lot easier by just sending a sample of stool for what's called a Sudan test, looking for fat globules, and that will give you a rough guesstimate if they are at risk for this, and then you can decide whether you want to try and do a prolonged fat collection, which your patients really do not like. Imaging, again, we discussed this earlier, might be able to help you with that diagnosis, and then we might use upper endoscopy or colonoscopy to look at various issues with what is left for the patient's anatomy. And short bowel syndrome has a significant impact on the quality of life for the patient as well as the family. For adults, there's a real concern of being a burden to others. Loss of independence and activities require a lot of planning and may be negatively impacting their ability to travel. Patients with short bowel syndrome, they are going to be more physically tired, annoyed. They're going to have problems sleeping because they're always worried about their children and their alarms for their PN. So it's difficult spending time with partners, shopping, taking holidays, doing other things that they need to do. They feel a little more frantic. And then if you've got children that are less than five, the impact on daily family activities and things that go on in the household and family relationships can certainly suffer. And the patient burden is significant. I think long-term parenteral nutrition is much more difficult than being a dialysis patient. For dialysis, you go to a dialysis unit, you're hooked up for several hours, you get to put your feet up, they give you a drink, you watch TV, and you go out and you have the rest of your day. With parenteral nutrition, you may be on IV nutrition for 8 to 24 hours a day, and this can have a negative effect on your mental health. And resources are intense. You have to prepare the parenteral nutrition, you have to store it effectively. You have to take it out of the refrigerator. You have to let it get to room temperature. You have to then put your additives in. You have to get it set on the pump. The pumps don't always work great, and catheter maintenance may be an issue. There are lots of risks. We'll talk about that later also. Line-associated infections, vascular complications with blood clots, whether it's localized to the catheter or pulmonary embolism. You can have parenteral nutrition-associated liver failure. That occurs more commonly with the children, but for patients that are on long-term parenteral nutrition, that can happen for adults in addition. And this is costly therapy. There are a lot of direct costs for the parenteral nutrition. There may be co-pays, insurance premiums, and then time to manage this is really uncompensated for either the patient or the caregivers and may lead to loss of employment and or loss of their insurance. The potential complications can be broken into a number of categories, whether it's the catheter itself with infection, occlusion, thrombosis, breakage of the catheter, hepatobiliary, steatosis, cholestasis, cirrhosis. Metabolic bone disease can be osteoporosis, osteopenia, osteomalacia. If you have a colon in circuit, you are at higher risk for developing oxalate stones, and that can really negatively affect your kidney function and cause you to either have acute kidney failure, chronic kidney disease, or acute episodes of trying to pass kidney stones. And then certainly nutrition deficits, we try to take care of those, especially if the patients are on enteral or parenteral nutrition. But malnutrition can occur, especially in the early setting when patients present to you. Dehydration, as I've mentioned, is very, very potentially serious, and there can be electrolyte and micronutrient imbalances, as well as a multitude of vitamin deficiencies. Let's turn to part two, the available and emerging treatment options to promote enteral autonomy and reduce parenteral nutrition support. Let's go to our second question. Which of the following would be the most appropriate first-line treatment for managing gastric hypersecretion in patients with short bowel syndrome? A. Proton pump inhibitors. B. The histamine 2 receptor antagonists. C. Octreotide. D. Clonidine. Or E. I don't know. Very good. Many of you did choose proton pump inhibitors. Let's look at the hallmark of what we need to do with these patients and treating patients. The first thing we really need to do is deal with their diet. And the shorter their bowel is, the more they need this dietary teaching. And the goals here are really to enhance the absorptive capacity and improve nutritional status and reduce the need for parenteral nutrition. Our dietary strategies, we go for 5 to 6 smaller meals and/or snacks a day. We avoid simple carbohydrates, less free sugar. We limit lactose and artificial sweeteners, especially the sugar alcohols. If patients have a colon and you're giving them too many artificial sweeteners, that can promote diarrhea on that basis. We really want to try to maintain hyperphagia with these patients and encourage them to eat, but eat the right things, and try to give them less dietary restrictions. Oral fluid intake is key, and I'll come back to that. Vitamin mineral supplements, depending on whether or not they are trying to wean off parenteral nutrition, we may have to give them a lot of pills to swallow. Enteral nutrition may be used, whether it's oral or tube feeding, as a supplement to help try to get enough calories in the patient or to help the weaning process. Dehydration is a major concern in intestinal failure, and liquids may not be absorbed appropriately. So there are rehydration strategies, and I can't stress this enough. This is one of the things that I spend a lot of time discussing with patients, because if they are drinking fruit juices, sodas, other sweetened drinks, and even some of the commercial nutrition supplements, the high sugar content of these make these hypertonic and can actually pull fluid out of the patient rather than helping the patient. Also, since the time you were a little child, your mother probably told you on a hot summer day, drink plenty of water so you don't get dehydrated. Well, this is the same thing that many physicians tell their patients with short bowel syndrome, and that's not correct. Because if they're drinking too much water or hypertonic fluids, whether it's coffee, tea, or diet drinks, they may be causing the fluid to go out very, very quickly, sort of like liquid plumber, if you will. That's how I explain it to my patients. The things that we really try to get them to drink are solutions like Drip Drop, Pedialyte, Equalyte, Cerelyte, Liquid IV, and there's a whole host of these on the market. These were developed initially by the World Health Organization for cholera. In patients in third world countries that developed cholera, you don't die of the cholera infection, you die of dehydration. So if you're able to replace some of that fluid effectively, and the small bowel can do that because it has a sodium glucose co-transporter, if you put it in the right chemical proportion, you will absorb it very well. Here's a list of the homemade way to do this. It's with water, salt, and a small amount of sugar, and you can add a flavoring to it. And I'll leave that up for a second for you to take that down. This is real crux of what we try to get patients to drink when they have short bowel and intestinal failure. Let's turn to the therapeutic opportunities in short bowel. When you have acid hypersecretion, well, we can suppress that with different medications. If they have rapid transit, we can slow it with what we call our bowel stoppers. For bacterial overgrowth, we can give different antibiotics. For bile acid wasting, we can bind some of those bile acids. And there's a whole host of medications that we can use for treating our patients with short bowel syndrome, but I have to tell you that there's very few that are actually approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So I'm telling you that up front as I'm going to go through these. The first thing that we may do is give them gastric acid suppression. If they can take oral medications, we'll give them proton pump inhibitors. If they're on IV parenteral nutrition, we often put the H2RAs into our parenteral nutrition solutions because the proton pump inhibitors are not compatible with our parenteral nutrition solutions. We then go to our bowel stoppers. Loperamide is the number one that we use. We will also use diphenoxylate. You can use these together. That's like using an acetaminophen and an ibuprofen together. They both do similar things, but they can be additive. And this is the same with loperamide and diphenoxylate. We will often use in severe patients two pills of each, and we give it to them 30 minutes before a major meal. So it is in the system and slows things down more effectively. In the UK, they use codeine with loperamide more commonly than we do in the US, where we use more diphenoxylate. It's easier to get codeine in the UK as opposed to the US, which is very difficult to get approved by insurance often. And sometimes what we have to do is we will add it to acetaminophen. And acetaminophen number three has 30 milligrams of codeine. And that combination will also have 325 milligrams of acetaminophen. With that, 4 pills of that a day is going to be well under the 4 grams maximum that you should be telling your patients to take for other reasons. Tincture of opium is also used for anti-motility. It is an older medication. Patients don't like the taste. You should be giving that to them not in drops like they did 40 years ago, but in milliliters. If you have a patient with poor eyesight, that may not be the best of options for your patient. Other anti-secretory agents, octreotide. You can give octreotide injections. Your patient will not like you because the octreotide injections do hurt. There is a depot version if octreotide does work for your patient. We often put the octreotide into their parenteral nutrition, and that may also help. Clonidine is another way of doing this. We often worry about hypotension with those patients, but you can actually use this as a patch, and that minimizes that. The problem with the anti-secretory medications is they will act negatively in terms of intestinal adaptation. So while you're trying to help your patient's gut adapt and maximally absorb and work on absorbing better, these drugs will decrease the secretion and not be as good for that. For small bowel and bacterial overgrowth, we can use either antibiotics or probiotics. For bile acid sequestrants, we can use cholestyramine. The trophic agents that we can use growth hormone or the GLP analogs. The only FDA approved one at this point is teglutetide. Recombinant growth hormone can promote crypt cell proliferation. It can decrease parenteral nutrition needs. Its use is limited by adverse effects. It is FDA approved. I can tell you that this has fallen out of favor in the last decade. Most intestinal rehabilitation programs do not use this. They will move on to other things such as the GLP-2s, surgery for this, or intestinal transplant. The GLP-2s, or glucagon-like peptide 2, are secreted mainly in cells in the distal small bowel or proximal colon. They will mediate increased jejunal absorption through an induction of jejunal epithelial proliferation, and they can slow gastric emptying and increase intestinal transit time. For many of the patients that you'll be seeing, those areas of gut have been resected, the distal small bowel and the proximal colon. So the GLP-2 analogs have been found, and they are approved. Teglutetide is approved by the FDA for adults and pediatric patients greater than age one who are dependent on parenteral nutrition. There are other GLP-2 medications in the pipeline, so to say. Both apraglutide and glepaglutide have finished their phase three trials, but they have not been approved by the FDA at this point. And one other one is in the early phases of clinical trials. Teglutetide, in a 24-week study of patients with short bowel syndrome and intestinal failure, this is administered as a sub-Q injection, and it was compared to placebo. And you can see here that there was a significant percentage of patients that had a 20% reduction in PN volume from baseline at weeks 20 and 24. And the long-term efficacy of this drug is incredibly good. Over a long period of time, it does continue to help the patients. So the patients need to stay on this medication long time. If we look at the pooled analysis of the five clinical trials with 134 patients, roughly 12% achieved enteral independence or enteral autonomy. This is the holy grail. We want to get patients off their parenteral nutrition, and if we can, then get their central catheters removed. So here, baseline requirements and the duration ranged from 2 to 18 years, days per week that they were receiving, nutrition support from 3 to 6 days. 75% of patients required greater than a year before they could come off their parenteral support. Interestingly, one patient took 2.5 years, so never say never. Keep working with that patient. They may have more time to adapt and be able to come off PN. And it's a wonderful day to be able to say that they don't need it any longer. The efficacy here you can see is very good, whether you're looking at the pediatric portion of this trial, where the difference in the amount of teglutetide from 0.25 milligrams per kg to 0.05 milligrams per kg showed a slight improvement. But look at the difference between standard of care. These patients that received the medication did extremely well compared to just standard of care. And again, this is looking longitudinally at what happened with these patients and a nice reduction in the amount of parenteral solutions needed for these patients compared to standard of care, where there was very little effect. The side effects for teglutetide are very, actually fairly minimal. The GI stoma complication is probably the most significant complication compared to placebo. Abdominal pain and other things listed here are essentially the same. So the main thing to take from this slide is there may be some stomal issues. Basically, what happens is your patients, you'll see the small bowel look like a pile carpet. The villi get very large and can fill up the lumen a little bit, and it's quite dramatic when you see these patients. So they might have some stomal issues. So the type of monitoring that we do when we use GLP-2s, we always are worried about the risk of accelerated neoplastic growth. Remember, we're using this medication to help grow some of the intestinal cells. So we worry about also growing other things. For pediatric screening, it's important for a baseline and annual fecal occult blood screening, colonoscopy or sigmoidoscopy at year one and every 5 years, or if blood in the stool. We like to have a baseline colonoscopy or sigmoidoscopy in the adults with a repeat at 1 year and then 5 years thereafter, or if polyps are removed, you may decide to investigate earlier. Patients may have intestinal obstruction symptoms or develop an intestinal obstruction. Remember, you are growing the villi, and if patients have strictures, they may obstruct if the villi get a little bigger. So that is something that can occur. Fluid overload, especially when you're starting the medication, is something that can occur. And you need to be ready to start decreasing the amount of parenteral nutrition support that you're giving these patients when you are giving this medication. So the first several weeks may be a little more labor intensive in trying to adjust their fluids. There can be pancreaticobiliary disease that occurs. We generally will monitor their lipase and amylase before and during therapy. And remember, we are improving absorption of nutrients. Well, what about medications? Suddenly, they might be absorbing some of their medications better, and you've got to be prepared for that. You may have to decrease the dosage of medication that you're giving them. And if a patient has had an active malignancy within 5 years, that's generally a contraindication to a GLP-2. So, considerations for the GLP-2, certainly the patients need to make the meet the criteria. Either parenteral nutrition or IV fluids are required at least 3 times a week for greater than a year. We want to make sure that they've been optimized on dietary therapy, anti-secretory drugs, or antidiarrheals, that there's no malignancy contraindication, and you need to have a team that is ready to take care of these patients to make sure that they don't become fluid overloaded or other problems. So, in managing these people, looking at the overview, we want to attempt to wean some of these patients as best we can. First, we need to optimize the oral diet and fluids. I can't emphasize enough the importance of those oral rehydration solutions. The aggressive use of either anti-motility or anti-secretory medications. Think about maximizing function by surgically helping that remnant bowel. There are several techniques that are used for this. We need to monitor them carefully, and we need to watch their vitamin and mineral levels. And if PN is still needed and we can't enhance the bowel function, we can give GLP-2s. They are quite costly, as is parenteral nutrition. And parenteral nutrition really reduces the quality of life. If you can give the patient a day off a week or more, that improves their quality of life dramatically. If they have 1 to 2 hospitalizations annually for infections or thrombosis or other things, they might actually be candidates for intestinal transplant also. So, with that being said, we will try to wean patients, and we might think of using the GLP-2s, autologous surgical reconstruction. If they're tolerating home parenteral nutrition, we may just let them continue on. I've had patients that I have managed continuously for over 30 years, and these patients do have a good quality of life if you watch and see how you're taking care of them. For patients that are ultra short, they have less than 35 centimeters of small bowel, intestinal transplant may be their only good way to retain a good quality of life. And remember, intestinal transplant, there are very few centers that do that across the US. You have to go to a center that does intestinal rehabilitation as well as intestinal transplant, and there are only very few of those in the US. We're going to move on to part three, coordinating care with interdisciplinary and interprofessional short bowel syndrome specialists. And I'm going to turn this over to Anne.
Hello, everybody. Here is our final audience response question. What is one of the greatest barriers to smooth transition between pediatric and adult care? A, patient unwillingness to move to a new provider. B, failure to initiate transition in a timely manner. C, lack of providers who care for adult patients with short bowel syndrome. D, loss of social support networks. E, I don't know. The correct answer is lack of providers who care for adult patients with short bowel syndrome. Why do lack of providers exist? Well, as mentioned earlier, it's a relatively rare condition, and physicians and providers have rare encounters with these patients. This limits their exposure, limits their experience and expertise in caring for these patients. It also requires a high level of knowledge. It requires a multidisciplinary team, and there's limited training in medical school. Creating communities of practice in short bowel syndrome. This slide illustrates the importance of team approach to short bowel syndrome. It's, as mentioned earlier, it's a relatively rare condition affecting around 30,000 children and adults in the US, but the exact number is unclear. And as Dr. Kirby said, it's high risk, resource intense, expensive, and time consuming. So this, as you see, requires a multidisciplinary team to safely manage these patients. So we have the patient into the center and also the patient's caregivers. And also, so we have the gastroenterologist, the primary care physician, the pediatrician, the registered dietitian, social worker and case manager, home health providers, the GI and parenteral nutrition nurses, and the surgeons. Transition of care. Transition, this slide provides recommendations for transition of care from pediatrics to adult patients by the American Academy of Pediatrics. The guidelines include transition planning should begin at age 12. Ideal transfer to adult-oriented care occurs between age 18 and 21. Transition planning should be part of a standard clinical care. and transition planning should be individualized. It should be fluid and responsive to the patient's needs. Transition of care can take up to 2 years. With the improvement of medical and surgical management of pediatric onset chronic conditions, we see more and more young people thriving and surviving into adulthood. Transition of care is critical to ensure transition from a pediatric family approach, centered approach to adult care, which includes full autonomy, self-management, and new responsibilities to maintain success. Here at the Cleveland Clinic, we admit adult patients who need to initiate TPN, and then we have to transition them to home TPN. We have caseworkers or case managers who are social workers and nurses who help us find home health care and home infusion pharmacies for these patients. We also have nurses who evaluate the patients to see if their home is safe. Can the patient manage the TPN at home? Do they have dexterity? Do they have a refrigerator and electricity for the pump and the bags? And do they have support? If the nurse finds these patients do not have support at home or can't manage the TPN at home, then they will go to a facility. Strategies for a smooth transition. The most important thing is to find a provider. As mentioned earlier, we have a shortage of adult providers, and it's a major challenge for patients with short bowel syndrome. We have patients from all coming here from all over the world initiating TPN, and they want to go back home to be taken care of, but it's very hard for them to find a local provider. For pediatric patients, it's important to have a structured handoff appointment between the pediatrician and the new adult provider. It's best in person, but if not, a virtual visit will do. Transition summary note should be detailed. It should include a detailed medical history and treatment course. It should also include the surgical history, amount of remaining small bowel left, active problems, and complete set of nutritional labs. We gather the labs prior to discharge because they take a couple of weeks to come back. If the patient is on TPN, we'd like to know when it started, any complications related to it, line infection, elevated liver enzymes, edema, shortness of breath, among other. Identification of culture and linguistic support is also necessary. And you also want to understand, does this patient have special needs? Do they have a legal surrogate, et cetera? They also, can they make decisions for themselves? You want to engage a social worker to ensure continuity of care. A health coach can be helpful. It's important to have an emergency plan, and many practices have a written policy on transition to enhance agreement by those involved in this care. Here at the Cleveland Clinic, we have a patient partnership agreement, and this is a contract between the patient and the caregivers that lists expectations, responsibilities, and the need to comply with this. And if they don't, then a decision is made if the patient should continue with our service. Smooth transition is critical so the emerging adult has the skills and knowledge for self-management and independence related to their condition. Unfortunately, there's barriers to transition of care. Lack of planning or communication between the providers surrounding transition, lack of training in the disease state and parenteral nutrition care. Does the patient understand their anatomy? Do they understand when to take their meds? Do they understand the diet, the fluid requirements, like Dr. Kirby mentioned? Can they take care of their line? Do they know how to store their fluid? Do they understand how often they have to get labs, among other things? Lack of social support to replace previous caregiver support. The pediatric patient is usually cared for by their parents or a guardian, and they do all the scheduling and appointments and lab work, et cetera, and care of the line. And now the patient's an adult, and they have these responsibilities on their own. the inability to locate an adult specialist with knowledge of pediatric short bowel syndrome, as I mentioned earlier, and the patient or caregiver reluctance to transition. The parent might feel like their fear of letting go of their responsibilities. And the caregiver now could feel anxious because they have increased responsibilities, overwhelmed with self-care, and the fear from the unknown. There's loss of insurance or financial assistance. Usually you're under your parents' plan, and now you're out on your own. Can you work? Can you go to school? Things like that. Lack of adequate support increases a risk for poor follow-up, poor self-management, decreased quality of life, increased hospitalizations, and increased healthcare costs. Supporting under-resourced communities, such as rural, remote, and poor communities, home parental nutrition increases a sense of normalcy in patients' lives. It increases the quality of life. You're surrounded by friends, family, familiar surroundings. You can go back to your hobbies, hopefully, go back to work or go back to school. Telehealth opens up opportunities such as allowing community providers to create a team of providers without leaving their area or going into the doctor's office. It facilitates multidisciplinary care teams' visits with multiple specialists. It increases access to specialists who may not be available locally. Access to urgent evaluations for complications, concerns, or questions, and increased access to clinical trials or new meds. Dr. Kirby, what are your thoughts on how we might improve access to care in under-resourced communities?
Well, right now we're under COVID rules for telehealth, and it's really been very good for us to be able to treat patients in multiple states. The Cleveland Clinic currently has home parenteral nutrition patients in 38 of the 48 contiguous states. So being able to help those patients locally so they don't always have to travel here is great. However, there are going to be some major changes in telehealth over the next few months, and that has me a little nervous for many of our patients, or having new patients that we could consult with and help their primary care physicians or their local communities to take care of them effectively so they don't always have to travel to a center of excellence. So I think that is probably my biggest fear in the upcoming months.
And Dr. Kirby, in your experience, what is the most challenging aspect of care transitions?
Once again, not having enough adult caregivers that are comfortable doing parenteral nutrition. And I think that's an issue. And I think you're going to tell us that there are some resources. And so why don't you share that with us, Anne?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, the next two slides go over resources to help with care transitions. The first slide helps with pediatrics to adult care. GOT Transition is a national resource center that has helps the pediatric patient move towards the adult care. And Doc for Me is an app that helps young adults, emerging adults who have inflammatory bowel disease find an inflammatory bowel disease adult provider. And then the next slide goes over support for short bowel syndrome used for patients and providers. We have the Short Bowel Syndrome Foundation, we have the Olie Foundation, and we have the American Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, also known as ASPEN. Now I'll turn things back over to Dr. Kirby to wrap up.
Thanks, Anne. We want to finish today by summarizing our SMART goals. This stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. First, we want to develop a plan to manage the risks and complications associated with short bowel syndrome, intestinal failure, and parenteral nutrition. We need to consider socioeconomic barriers that might prevent patients from receiving parenteral nutrition or advanced pharmacotherapy. We want to optimize nutrition and rehydration plans for patients with short bowel syndrome, intestinal failure. We want to utilize advanced pharmacotherapy such as GLP-2 analogs in appropriate patients with short bowel syndrome dependent on parenteral nutrition. And we need to assemble a care transition team to support smooth transition between pediatric and adult care. In conclusion, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion regarding closing gaps in care for short bowel syndrome in the community setting. Have a nice day.